Hello, this is Sounds Choral. When the pandemic hit in March, the curtain came down on performing arts, and because of the nature of COVID-19, an iron curtain on singing and the choral art. This week is the second in documenting a Zoom roundtable discussion with the illustrious roster of hosts for this program, talking about their beloved art form.
Brian Brando, the director of three ensembles, Princeton for Musica, the Mama Civic Chorus, and Amar Artists.
Gabriel Crouch, the founder and director of the UK-based vocal ensemble Gallicantus and the director of choral activities at the very much New Jersey-based University of Princeton.
James Jordan, Westminster Choir College, conductor of Williamson Voices, conductor of the Same String Choir, and also one of the many faculty at the Choral Institute of Oxford.
Stephen Samets, the Ronald J. Ulrich Professor of Music at Lehigh University, the director of choral activities, and conduct the Choral Union, Glee Club, and the University Choir. Also the artistic director of the Princeton Singers.
Deborah Simpkin King, founder and artistic director of Schola Cantorum on Hudson, which is the parent organization of Project Encore, also of the performing ensemble Ember and of the education program Phoenix.
Ethan Sperry, the Barry Stoll Professor of Choral Music at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, and also the artistic director and conductor of the Oregon Repertory Singers, a community chorus based in the Portland, Oregon area.
One host who could not be with us for the entire roundtable was Dr. Amanda Quist, Director of Choral Activities at the Frost School of Music at the University of Miami, for she was teaching a class online. Program 1 last week, which is up on our website as a webcast, hope you can check it out, we asked each host to recall the time in March when it came crashing down with such suddenness. This week, we'll bring it up to the present and what they are doing to facilitate singing in some fashion, and then next week, the final program will look past the pandemic and how this will and might change choral music moving forward. All the music you hear in these programs was chosen by the hosts. We recorded this roundtable on the last day of September, and you just heard one of our hosts, Deborah Simpkin King, lead her Ember vocal ensemble of Schola Cantorum on the Hudson, and John Mulison's Singing Together. As a timeline, there was a study that came out right after March. Ethan, you were kind of involved with that, about everything we've been talking about and how choral singing would be greatly affected. On a personal note, at the beginning of May, I was on a Zoom panel run by Richard Tang-Yuk, who up until recently ran the Princeton Festival, and everybody on there, except for me, was conducting a choral ensemble or an opera company. So it was all about singing. And they had little questions that went out to the audience that were watching. I don't know how many there were. And they could vote. And one of the questions was, what would bring you back into a concert hall with opera or choral? And the overwhelming majority, and this was back in May, was not until there was a vaccine. The summer goes on. We've heard from these hosts of ours, these six hosts. One host that isn't joining us is Amanda Quist, formerly of Westminster, now down choral activities down at University of Miami, Florida. And she can't be with us because she's teaching right now. And I guess that is one of the things that has changed as we've come up to now in the fall. So this is open to all of you, but here we are now in the fall. Back in May, we thought things would be better in the fall. Well, they're not. They're not going to be better come the calendar turn on January 1st either. But things have changed. There's been adaptations. There's been alterations. There's been thinking out of the box, all kinds of things. You've mentioned some things you've done in the interim, but talk to what's happening right now that is different from what we've just heard.
Full disclosure, I had three really hard weeks of lockdown, and I was struck by the fact that one of my students was a composer in quarantine, and he and I talked, and his cousin was head of one of the ERs in New York, the height of the pandemic, and she called it the Great Reset, and I kind of liked that. She said, life will never be the same as we exit, and that's what I've been trying to prepare my own graduate conducting students for, and frankly, myself. I hate to say this, but Ethan, I was corrected by a student in Germany who I was teaching, and I was horrified that I think in everything I've written, I've never used the word empathy. And he corrected me, and he said on page 165 or something in Evoking Sound, I did use the word empathy. But I think what we've learned is empathy in other ways other than sound, seeing, as Stephen said, in boxes on the screen. And for 4 weeks I wrote, because I think I didn't particularly school myself well in empathy. And so coming out, facing this year, we're on another campus, our students are all over the world. And I made the objective, this is just me, I had to do something that you would be learning music. So I kind of combined my psychology of music background and thought, came down to some essential things that I think probably, at least I didn't really teach well. It's an opportunity, I've kind of embraced it, and we have our regular rehearsals Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They have a 10-page guide to a virtual rehearsal of learning where there's a step-by-step procedure by which they learn music. My choir is in breakout rooms by section. They have to test everything. I have a master class day where we work through the score. And the other thing that I found really interesting, I thought to myself, what is it that communicates other than our parts and what we do in the community? But what is it that you want your singers to really pay attention to? And the issue is breathing and the information that comes on the horizontal parts of our gesture. What am I doing? What kind of line? So on Zoom, I've been doing rehearsals where they're literally picking up signals. They're singing on mute and then go to sectionals and kind of apply. I'm marking scores better than I ever did, I hate to say, but with lots of detail. I'm coloring scores so that they have the visual. And I think when we come out of this, I actually think I'm going to be a better rehearsal guy, because I'm not going to be doing everything in rehearsal that I always thought would always be, and it's not. So our objective was to learn music. And I must say, as just a blatant commercial, thank God for Matthew Curtis and Choral Tracks. That's all I'm going to say. My students adore them. We're doing this piece, Ave Verum Reimagined, by Roddy Williams, which is in four choirs. And God love him, he's recorded that for us. But having that kind of aural image, being able to practice, so we are rehearsing. The problem I have is we need to start singing together in the spring somehow, some way. And I don't know what that's going to be. If it's in small pods, I'll take it. If it's with the singer's masks, I'll take it. We so need to sing with each other, but I think we all know what we're in for. We're trying. And the other thing that I'm very excited about, we are outfitting several classrooms. Don't ask me, I'm just like a technological idiot. This is the latest and greatest equipment where I will be able to do a rehearsal with eight singers, each in a various location on the campus, and be in perfect sync. There's some kind of conversion box that they're installing as we speak in these ten classrooms, because my accompanist is in another room, but there'll be no lag. And then we're hoping to move to 30 setups, but it's been a learning curve. So that's kind of exciting and intriguing, but it doesn't make up for not being with people. It's killing me. But I do have rules when they're on Zoom. I got to see their face in the screen, and they cannot sit down. They cannot leave the screen. Somebody leaves, I say, we'll wait, and that stopped that. But I got to see their face, and I found a way that I can put 42 faces on a screen at one time, so they're right in front of me, and that helps my heart a little bit. So that's what we're doing, trying to make it work.
As we heard on a track on last week's program, Dr. Jordan here conducting his Same Stream Choir from a recording that will be released soon, titled To Hold the Light. Here they sing music of the Latvian composer Peteris Vasks, setting words of Mother Teresa, the fruit of silence.
I said something earlier about the fact that our communities were already together at the point where we had to shut down in the spring. And that's something that I've noticed really quite painfully this year, is that we've had to try to build a community from scratch online. And obviously we've never had to deal with that sort of thing before, and it's very, very difficult. And I think that, you know, one of the things that students have been dealing with everywhere is, if they are on a campus which is entirely virtual like ours is, and there are only a couple of hundred students at all on our campus, and they're only there if they have particular housing problems which qualify them. So almost all of our students are off campus, and it's been quite moving to talk to them about how there's an overhanging pall of sadness from not being able to interact with each other. And let's remember, I think we all have, you know, it's always good to remind ourselves of this, that however much we might try to occasionally dispense some useful information to our students, and, you know, and however much our universities might have great libraries and some decent professors, you know, really the thing that we really get from being a student at university is interacting with our peers. I mean, those are the people that really teach us. Those are the people that stay with us forever and that guide us through our own idea generation, and whose own ideas we're also able to feed. The interaction between students is, it's not just social, it's not just letting off steam, it's learning. So trying to find ways to get students together in meaningful ways has been a big challenge, and one that I've taken seriously, and I wouldn't dare to say that I've found ways to succeed, but it's taken a lot of my energy. One thing that's been interesting is that actually over the course of this summer, I think especially once it started to dawn on us that this lockdown was going to persist, I've been amazed by how much more contact I've had with students than I had before. It would never have occurred to me or my students for us to just arrange chats, just, you know, to kind of check in with each other in the middle of August. That would never have occurred to us. Whereas this summer, we were meeting every Sunday at lunchtime. We were meeting and talking about whatever it is we wanted to talk about. And to be honest, a lot of that was about issues that connect choral music making to social justice. That became a point of real connection for us, and that was incredibly valuable. One other thing that I sort of found to my surprise is that my ingrained cynicism about making virtual choir recordings has been slightly, has been blown away a little by realizing the impact and the value that it has for students. I certainly haven't tried to reinvent that Speminalium project in May, notwithstanding. I haven't tried to reinvent the wheel for me. It hasn't felt like a year to tackle really, really complicated repertoire, but just to do some things which remind us constantly of the value of hearing our voices together and feeling the effect that the product can, not the process, but the product can have on us, and that it also can have on, you know, on the people who are used to listening to us, our audience. And so that's been a point where my ingrained cynicism has been kept at bay, I would say. And then one other thing, I don't know how many of us here have been toying with the technology which allows people to sing together synchronously online, but that's been a very interesting part of this. It hasn't been rewarding musically, I would say, but led by some luminaries like Ian Howell at NEC, I've been part of that coterie of people following behind him, picking up on all of his insights about how to combine, you know, Soundjack and Jitsi Meet, and how to try to reduce latency and or eradicate latency when putting voices together, have them sing together synchronously. I think we're still at the point where that is fascinating and, you know, and appeals to the nerdish quality within us rather than our, you know, something. There's nothing innately musical about it yet, but I do sense that it could be out there, and perhaps, you know, one other cause for optimism here is the fact that we might, we don't have it yet, but we might eventually learn to harness technology in a way that will actually allow us to have meaningful musical experiences in a world where cramming thousands of people and an audience into a concert hall and staging Verdi Requiem or whatever might not be a reality that we can assume will always be there for us. I hate to be too portentous about this, but I think that that's one of the things that we ought to consider, is how we will deal with future pandemics. I was one of those people who noticed when Ethan Sperry announced his rehearsal plans for the semester. I've been really keen to see what's going on over at Portland State, because that's a very exciting announcement. Ethan, I'm sure you'll tell us about that, whether that's come to fruition or not, but that was a very exciting moment in the summer.
I'm happy to talk quickly about it, because so far I have not been able to build it. My university announced something and I had my plans ready to go, And so I jumped at starting it, and then about 2 weeks later, they reversed course, and so far they will not give me permission to build this space. And
in which case, I apologize for
Brian. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. I did enough workshopping on it and design on it that I'm quite convinced it will work and be at a roughly similar price point to people who want to use JackTrip or whatnot. But there's a lot of barriers here. You need a very large space. But my idea was building just a lot of clear Mylar cubicles next to each other where everybody could sing on their own mic and headphones. The delay that comes from singing on the internet comes from the internet, not from the audio cables themselves. So if you can get the internet out of the equation and essentially put everyone in a recording studio but where everybody's in their own room, you could really make music together. And if the cubicles are small enough and they're made out of Mylar, everybody can really see each other and react to each other physically and react to a conductor and still make music in real time. And I was able to build a little test case of 8, and it was quite something. It really works sonically, and it's actually quite different from choir. When you're hearing the whole ensemble on headphones, every singer has a little bit more of the conductor's perspective. They hear everybody equally if the engineer is doing a good job and if the singers are doing a good job. They're not having that experience of, oh, I hear the couple people next to me much better than everybody else. The other thing that's very disconcerting, of course, is that singers can hear themselves. And that takes some time to get over. But I think it's a really viable project, and there is some expense on the ventilation system that you need to build to make sure that when people are singing in these booths, all the air gets exhausted out of the space. But I'm still fairly optimistic, and I'm fighting quite hard. I think we will probably still be going online with this in November, especially because the university is trying to keep us mostly virtual through winter quarter now. They've been letting us do small group rehearsals outside, and I just can't tell you if you can find the right acoustics anywhere. I love that people are doing virtual choirs. I've even done a couple of things myself, but I personally hope all of this is going to fail. I really don't want there to be an easy alternative to people getting together and having shared experiences in person, because I don't think the virtual experience really comes close in meeting the needs of those singers. And I get that it could be a really cool, like, it's better this than nothing during a pandemic, but I'm really worried about the long-term future of humanity if, like, the... I think a lot of us forget how powerful the in-person experience is when we don't have it for a while. I'm a choir director, and I know how much I value live choral music, but just the first time I heard these 8 students sing into their microphones on headphones in real time, we sang the very beginning of the Victoria Omnium Mysterium, and we got to the first chord of the piece, I burst uncontrollably into tears. Like, it just the power of that in person is something I don't want to forget, and I don't want to make it easier for the world to exist without it. So I get nervous, actually, about how far we want to push the virtual aspect of this. And I get all the good reasons why. And it's not, I'm not to say I'm not doing my own virtual choir projects, because we got to do something. Even if I can meet my singers together, you know, outdoors, still to communicate with our audience takes some level of virtual something. You know, it's still just all through a recorded medium. So it's a challenging time, and wish me luck. You know, maybe even by the time this show airs, I will have my little virtual choral studio up and running. I've had so many donors interested in this, not just funding it, but after my first space didn't work out, I've had one person donate an entire office building to us to use for this project. It's really cool. And I have another contractor. This is a simple DIY project, but my university will only do it if the professionals build it. I have a contractor who's looking at donating all of his time to build the thing. A lot of people get the value of the arts and want to see it possible. And if it works, of course, you can put instrumentalists in the booths, too. It doesn't just have to be singers. But string players and pianists at least have a lot more options right now of playing together with masks on safely.
We've kind of moved into the area of where I wanted to go next, is the logistics of how we do this, what we do, how we sing. And shameless plug here, but I recorded a cadenza with Eric Whitaker, which is going to air in November, a two-parter. When you think of virtual choir, of course, he is the one you think of. And, of course, Whitaker 6, the latest incarnation of virtual choir, had over 17,000 people singing in it. All great, but from his mouth, this is not the answer. It's had many benefits. People who couldn't sing in a choir, people with cystic fibrosis or respiratory problems or whatever, get to do this. But from his mouth, it is not the answer. It is part of the mix. So there's virtual choirs. They're singing outdoors as long as the weather holds. Is it different for younger singers rather than older singers? Is community volunteer different from those that need to be paid or are used to being paid? I mean, this is all the cocktail of how do we do it if we're going to do it, so... Sounds Choral host Gabriel Crouch there leading his Gallicantus ensemble in music of the Princeton-based composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder from her Mass for the Endangered, a hymn to the voiceless and the discounted, a requiem for the not yet gone, using original text by poet Nathaniel Bellows in combination with the traditional Latin. We heard the Credo, built on a ground by fellow composer, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Caroline Shaw.
One thing that you're speaking to, David, is that of options. I'm another one who firmly does not believe that virtual choirs are the future of choral singing. I believe it's a real thing. I think it has a lot of value in some ways, but it is not the future of choral music, in my opinion. I do believe that the human spirit is at its best when it has options. And I think that's what we're discussing kind of right now. And virtual is one of the options to which we've turned. And I do know that there are some things that we will undoubtedly hold on to, at least in my experience, from working virtually with our singers, that will make us better musicians when we come out of this. James, I was hearing what you were saying in terms of the gestures. You know, we see ourselves differently and we feel the response differently. My singers have commented also on how much more they actually see of not only me, but of each other, because we're all on these little tiles as opposed to they're all either, you know, in a circle around or all facing one direction. So there are things that we'll hold on to for that. But one thing that one of my organizations, that Ember has done, is to actually develop a protocol and develop a specific mask that allowed us to do performances this past weekend for audiences. I'll share that experience, Ethan, that you mentioned. Hearing that first chord, we all just kind of had to have our breakdown time, and then we came back together, and then I started hearing something go awry, and I thought, okay, now we're getting to work, we're back in it. But there was such a need to be back together. And David, you mentioned the study that came out. It was, I believe, early June, late May, early June. It was right before the Chorus America conference. And it scared all of us. It angered some of us, you know, because it was all over the place. And it was well-intended people trying to put together what we knew at the time. But it was not an encouraging experience. That has now been superseded by a round two of that study, which does have a lot more concrete evidence of what the aerosol element is, what the air exchange rate needs to be for healthy singing, what the distancing is for singers, which, there's even something worse than singing, and that's playing a trombone. That's 9 feet, not 6 feet. And we know what kinds of fabrics filter in what ways. We've seen some products commercially available. And what we did was to design a mask that is of a higher filtration level than the most filtering one that I've seen commercially available. And that's what we commissioned of a seamstress and developed them and sang with them. The singers did really well with them. They adapted to them. We've learned some things that make them more comfortable. We don't find that it impacts the vocal timbre enormously. Obviously, there is some impact, but not a great deal. Our performances were outdoors. Our audiences were socially distanced in their outdoor arena, and we were socially distanced from each other. So acoustical environment, well, you know what? It focused us on how we work these voices. You know, can we develop a resonance cylinder, each singer individually, that is more expansive to orally overlap with that of other singers? We rehearsed our voices in ways that were very specific to a different acoustic. And that's what we do on tour anyway, isn't it? I mean, we send our singers into a new space and say, go warble, get used to how your voice interacts with this new acoustical environment. Very seldom are those outdoors, and usually they provide some kind of structural support for our sound. So it's different, but it was an option, and it allowed singers to actually make music together. We kept it very lightweight. In terms of repertoire, we felt that our audiences would need something that didn't stretch them, very easy to absorb. And the response from the audience, the response from the singers was overwhelming. So options.
I think options are what I'm finding with working for my ensembles right now. We're just getting started, so we can discuss this again in a couple of months. But I certainly went through a period over the summer of resistance. You know, I got into this line of work because I am so fascinated by acoustic music making, which is to say, if it's singers, there's this telepathy happening that is You know, it's aural, it's physical, that connection that we can forge in the rehearsal space and in performance, to me, is the magic of what we do. And as I'm sure we've all felt, even through Soundjack, that kind of thing, those non-oral cues just aren't there. The complete package, so far as I can tell, is impossible. You can line up the sound, but you don't get the sort of body language, or you can see each other really well on Zoom, but the sound is a mess. And likewise, I've been doing some work just trying to create orchestral music that my singers are used to singing with. And I love the translation from score to sound and the way that essentially musical style intervenes, right? If you get a section of violins and the section of cellos, they're all also communicating. And so it's heartbreaking to me that if I'm in a MIDI environment, I have to quantify, right? That there's a little less sound at the end of the bow in a long note. But that's the kind of thing that just happens naturally in real life. It's this sort of technological quantification of everything. I resisted very heavily. But finally, you know, I realized, but it's not about that. It's not about my resistance. It's what do these communities of singers need to do? And how can I make some lemonade out of these lemons? And so what we're doing is I'm trying to replicate the rehearsal paradigm, which is to say, they sing, I listen, I give feedback, they try it again, I listen, I give feedback, they try it again. So what I'm experimenting with is we hold a rehearsal on Zoom, during which I do some demonstrating. Some of my other singers will demonstrate a phrase, we mark scores. As Jim said, I think we're getting to a new level of detail in the score marking, which has been great. And then singers actually submit to me an audio recording of themselves singing to a backing track that I've made. I give them feedback on that. I send them back a voice memo saying, here's what was great, here's where I need to work on this, and here's a strategy to fix what you're struggling with. And we're only in the first round of this, but in the second round of this, I hope to actually send to them two or three singers at a time, you know, the voices that more naturally go together, and then they can sing their next iteration for me with the sound of their section mates, you know, in their ear. So I'm trying to do rehearsal in this digital way, and then mixing that with taking the time that we normally wouldn't have in rehearsal to talk about other issues of singing and choral singing. So we have someone coming in from Westminster to talk to us about vocal health and vocal fitness. Our Own Sounds choral host, Amanda Quist, is going to come talk to us about resonance in the voice. And I have somebody coming in to do a demonstration of bringing some Alexander principles into our singing and our living. And then we're going to do a couple of just big sing-ins, you know, sing through Brahms Requiem, sing through the B minor mass, and have a Messiah sing. And I'm going to have some guests come talk to us during those gatherings. So we're going to hear from Deshaun Burton and Jonathan Woody and just people out there in the choral field who can talk about the music of Brahms and Bach. And these are people who have performed with these groups before, and I just want them to see their faces again. It's interesting. It's a really double-edged sword. On the one hand, I think working with singers on this individual level has been very eye-opening for some of them in a sometimes hard to deal with way. Again, hearing one's own voice. And it's a little harder to have that courage when you're not in the sound of your ensemble. But it's also great that we're getting to work in this one-on-one fashion. It's something that we just don't have time to do on a weekly rehearsal basis. So it's been interesting, and we'll see where it takes us. You know, that what we're creating instead of a performance in person is just a recording, essentially, that's made up of all of our voices. So far, that's bringing us together. But I, too, hope that virtual choir isn't where we're headed. The utility of it thus far for my singers has been just the visual experience of seeing all those people together, I think, takes them into some part of their usual choral experience.
I'm getting inspired by hearing everybody else. If the question is, where are we now and what are we trying to do? I think we have to, first of all, face that we can't do what we would normally do. So we have to shift the paradigm somehow. I can just tell you some of the things that I've been doing, and it tends to overlap with my two roles as a composer and a conductor. First of all, we want to take care of the artists. We want to give them something that they can hang on to, that they feel like, you know, there's some enrichment going on. For Princeton singers, my pro group, first of all, I was just shout out to the donors and our supporters, because we managed to cover the entire season for them, that they would have lost their income. And I think being a singer in this environment is incredibly difficult. Having to look at their secondary skills and figure out how they're going to make money, it's just so difficult. So we managed to cover all their fees that they would have gotten for the last season. That was very generous of our donors. And because we're on intermission, essentially, with this professional group, I decided I would write each of them a solo song and that we would produce these somehow, either virtually or if we can get together. So I now have my Princeton Singers Pandemic songbook. And they all sent in texts that they were interested in. And I sort of made a deal with myself that I would set whatever they sent, which they sent some stuff that I, frankly, wouldn't have gotten on my radar as a composer. So it was very interesting for me to do that, and I got back into writing solo song literature, which was, you know, very nice for me. So now we're producing all these cameos of Princeton singers doing what they do. They make music, and we're able to, thankfully, pay them to do that. So we're trying to keep that artistic front open and creating new music, which I think is what Princeton singers kind of has a profile for anyway. For my college students, I've tried to find a different ground. We're doing actually a couple projects that changed the narrative. I mean, the narrative was for them, they come to rehearsal, somebody tells them how to get some things going or right or better. They learn their pieces, they do a concert, they get satisfaction out of that. That was not gonna happen. I mean, just, we didn't know how to make that happen anymore. So I came up with a narrative actually with Lisa Graham in Wellesley called There's No Place Like Home. And this idea about where are we now that we can't really have a sense of home? And that's a super broad kind of discussion, especially for students right now who feel very displaced. Their sense of home was campus. And for many of them, going back to their family home may not have been the perfect thing that they wanted to do. Some are in great families, but we acknowledge that some have difficult families. And what we started the year with was a kind of retreat where we opened that discussion about what is home, what is the sense of belonging, what is community? Because as many of us have kind of alluded to, it's the sense of community that arises in choirs that is magic, and it's what people remember for the rest of their lives. Music is the medium for that. It resonates with us, but we remember who we sung with. Having that conversation with the students, like right off the bat, was so powerful. They started where you might think they would have started, which is, oh, my sense of home is my town or my church. But, you know, I kind of invited the conversation to get wider. I said, okay, home is not unicorns and rainbows for everybody. And then the sharing began. And it was so powerful. And it was so immediately created community in a way that got everybody past being in little tiles. And for me, that was really what I was hoping would arise. You know, people told, you know, various stories, and I don't need to go into all those stories right now, but everybody was with them in that moment. And to me, trying to keep that community going through this project that we're having now. So students are writing pieces about their sense of belonging and home. I'm coaching them and writing them. The students are learning the pieces. We're doing the best we can to make tracks of those. We're also taking some other pieces that address that theme. So we're building this narrative around what is a sense of belonging. And that comes out in surprising ways for a lot of people. But I think it also reemphasizes that the singing community is where a lot of people find that. And we're not going to replace that with technology, ever, I don't think. I think that's why we will always have choral singing. We'll always have Sounds Choral, like you, Dave. The other thing that they're looking at is a different project, which Deborah sort of alluded to that she does with her groups. We're working with Andre de Quadros' group, Voices 21C in Boston, to try to create a project around Voices 21C, for those that don't know it, is a group that is a choral group that does a lot of things on themes of social activism. It's very powerfully presented, and the music arises organically from the themes. I mean, to me, if you're 18 to 22 year old right now and you don't have a thought about systemic racism or climate change or immigration or, you know, music in the prisons, you've been asleep for a little bit, and this is a good chance to wake up. So we're treating those themes and creating music around it and seeing what happens from that. Again, we can't just say we're going to have everybody rehearsing a a holiday program right now. It's not open to us. So we're finding other ways of framing the conversation, writing music into that, writing poetry into that, doing interviews with people. And the interviews with the home, because it includes my community choir, where I have people who are up to 90. And, you know, their perspective on what's home and what they miss about choral singing is going to be very different than what somebody who's 18 might think. So the project itself is, I think, it's very interesting. We're still trying to overcome the technology, of course, of actual music making, but we're just finding other ways of doing things. And just one last note, in the whole composer realm, and I thought all my commission pieces would basically go away. Actually, I'm getting commissions to write pieces, and it's very exciting this time to try to write, because much of my writing, for those who know it, tends to be, well, or can be asynchronous. This is a great time to be writing asynchronous pieces. It's just, if you want a big blur in your choir, you know, I love how that timbrely can arise. So to me, this is actually an opportunity. We don't have rhythm anymore. We don't have synchronous rhythm very easily as a component of what we do. So what are we going to do to make music that can do something else? And I'm delighted that Chanticleer, a group we all know, is premiering a piece of mine October 3rd, and they're doing it through the festival that Voices 8 is doing from London. So some groups are finding a way, and I just commend them for doing that.
Here is music of Stephen Sametz as he leads his Princeton Singers in a setting of E.E. Cummings' In Time Of.
In time of life.
The conclusion of our Zoom roundtable with our Sounds Choral hosts will be on next week's program, where we'll look past COVID and how choral music will, might, should change. We'll conclude with two settings, a monumental setting of the famous Dona Nobis Pacem, the final minutes of Ralph Vaughan Williams' setting from 1936, mixing texts from the Mass, three poems by Walt Whitman, a political speech, and sections of the Bible. And then the Dona Nobis Pacem from Johann Sebastian Bach's B minor Mass. I'm David Ozenberg, producer of Sounds Choral, which is produced here at the studios of WWFM, the Classical Network. You can listen to any recent Sounds Choral program by going to our website, wwfm.org, and clicking on Classical and Webcasts. You can also support programming like this with a donation in membership at our website. Thanks so much for listening. Sounds Choral is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and wwfm.org.